Who knows the parable of the talents? Who's heard that one? Yeah, much better. Who knows where to find it? Yes, Matthew 25, I heard from over here, or was that my imagination? Matthew 25, turn to there in your Bibles. Matthew 25 from verse 14. We're going to spend a couple of minutes looking at this, but before we do, and as the kids make their way, I think all the kids have realized now, junior church is on, so enjoy that. Before we get stuck into this parable of the talents, I want to just ask another question. Hopefully your hands are ready this time. Who watches reality TV shows like Amazing Race, The Renovators, Who's Got Talent, Not Me, you know, all those sorts of shows? Who watches those? Okay, we love them, don't we? I was watching one during the week. This one was a renovation show, and I don't watch it regularly. I flicked on, I'd gotten home from a meeting, and I was just relaxing, and it was the elimination stage, and this lady, she was really feeling it. She was competing against two other people. They had to put together a bed. It was like something you'd get from IKEA. It was flat-packed. They had to put this thing together, make it to the judge's satisfaction, and the last one to finish that task would be out of the show. And she's really nervous because she's never put one together, but she's desperate to stay in the show. She wants to continue her journey, and so she's really feeling it. And as somebody watching on, you're really feeling it for her, going, come on, you can do it, you can do it. But she didn't. She lost, and she was booted out. And she really felt horrible at being eliminated from this TV show. A lot of our shows are like that. They feature a judgment of some sort. And whether it's a judgment in terms of popularity, how many people ring up and say, yes, we want so-and-so to stay in the show, or whether there are certain things that you have to do to the judge's satisfaction, a lot of these shows, whether it's somebody wants a wife, somebody wants a husband, somebody needs to finish a race, somebody has to cook a meal, whatever it is, there's some sort of judgment to say whether you've made it or whether you haven't made it. And usually there's only one or two winners and a whole lot of losers, isn't that right? So keep that in mind as we approach the parable of the talents. If people get really worked up, both as participants in these shows and for thousands of people watching them as we, come on, you can do it, you know, stay another week, you might even win. If we get worked up about that sort of judgment, how much more should we care about the judgment that Jesus is talking about in this story? Let's begin reading from Matthew 25 and verse 14. Again, Jesus says, now, it'd be helpful to know, what's he referring to when he says again? So he's been telling a whole lot of stories, and he's trying to get across to the people what it's like, the fact that he is going away and will then return. And when he returns, he's going to come in glory and he's going to judge the earth. What does it mean for us to live as people in that in-between period, between when he's gone away and when he's coming back? That's what Jesus has been speaking quite a lot about to his followers. Again, he says, it will be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted his wealth to them. I want us to get to know the characters of this story. Most of you already know sort of what the story is all about. But let's get to know the characters a little bit better. There's like a man going on a journey. Later on in the story, he's called the master. Now, Jesus doesn't explicitly identify himself as being this man, but if you're reading from chapters 24 and 25, it's pretty clear he's talking about himself going away and then coming back in glory to judge. And it's pretty clear that that is what is in view here. He's going to receive his inheritance. He's going to come back and claim his bride when he returns to judge the earth. In fact, as this story finishes in verse 31, Jesus is moving on to a different way of illustrating this idea. And he begins that next story by saying, when the Son of Man comes in all his glory with the holy angels with him. Clearly, he's talking to his followers here about his departure and his return. So in their minds, as they're hearing a story about a master who goes away, then comes back, they're thinking this is Jesus. He's wanting to understand something about his return. Well, the next characters, of course, are the servants. This person went away and he entrusted all he had to these servants. And this is where you and I come in. Jesus says he's teaching people how to live as we wait for his return, either as we wait to go and stand before him or as he returns to come and meet us. How should we live? 2 Corinthians chapter 5 verse 10 says this, for we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one may receive what is due him for the things done while in the body, whether good or bad. So the Bible affirms that we will be judged according to what we've done while in the body and will appear before the judgment seat of Christ, just as the servants in this story were judged by Christ. So how are we to live? How are we to live as servants expecting their master's return. That's what Jesus wants to talk about in this story. Before we go any further, I just want to remind you of a phrase from the story that Ross was just talking about. Remember, as Jesus commissioned Peter for his task, how did he do that? He said, Peter, yeah, that was the task, feed my sheep. What was the question first? Do you love me? Do you love me? Three times, do you love me? Keep that in mind as you read this story. But for now, realize that like Peter in that story that we just reflected upon, like the servants in this parable that Jesus tells, we're a servant. We've been given a task to do. And so as we read this story, how are we going to apply that to ourselves? How do we fit in? Which type of servant will he be? Let's look at what the servants did from verse 15 onwards. To one he gave 5 talents of money, to another 2 talents, and to another 1 talent. You know when somebody says, oh, that person is so talented. This is where we get that saying from. A talent in those days was just a measure, and it measured about 6,000 average days' work. All right, now, just to put that into some sort of sense for you, I looked up the figures for what WA's average wage was last year, and that equates to about $1.2 million in terms of average payment for an Australian or a Western Australian day's work. So that's the sort of money we're thinking about. Now, if you have an older translation like mine, it'll say something like, this is more than $1,000. Well, in today's talk, it's more than $1 million. This is a lot of money that we're talking about here. So entrusted to 1, 5, another 2, and to another 1 talent, each according to his ability. Then he went on his journey. The man who had received the 5 talents went at once and put his money to work and gained 5 more. So also the one with the 2 talents gained 2 more. But the man who had received the 1 talent went off, dug a hole in the ground, and hid his master's money. So you got the first 2 servants, and they went straight away to work. And eventually, we don't know how long it took them, but we do know that the master was away a long time. For in verse 19 it says, after a long time, the master of those servants returned and settled accounts with him. So after a long period of time, having gotten to work straight away, these guys doubled the investment. One guy who had 5 earned 5. The one who had 2 earned 2. So they earned a fair bit of dough for their master. But neither the time frame, however long a long time is, and by the way, in those other stories that Jesus tells in around this chapter, he hints that it's a really long time. For example, in his other stories, the people who were waiting for him sort of gave up hope that he was ever coming back. They grew careless and despondent. They started indulging themselves, thinking they were never going to be held accountable. So Jesus has been hinting to his followers he could be gone a long time. And so as these guys have worked for a long time, they've doubled their money, but the amount of money they earned and the amount of time it took them to earn it isn't really the point. The point is that they worked hard and got a return. Why did they do that? What motivated them to work for a long period of time for somebody else's gain, for the master's gain, not their own? Well, to answer that, we need to first look at what the other servant did from verse 20 on. The man who had received the 5 talents brought the other... I didn't even read out that bit. The man who'd received the 5 talents brought the other 5. Master, he said, you entrusted me with 5, I've gained 5 more. His master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful with a few things. I'll put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. The man with the 2 talents also came. Master, he said, you entrusted me with 2 talents. See, I've gained 2 more. His master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful with a few things. I'll put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. So these are the guys that worked hard. Why did they work hard? Well, we'll get to that in a minute when we look at the other servant's example. But there was just something I find interesting in that. What did they comment on? Master, this is what I did for you. This is what I earned. I started with 5, I earned 5 more. I started with 2, I earned 2 more. What does the master comment on? You earned 5. Brilliant. That'll be really helpful. I'm glad you earned 5. That's $6 million more in my bank. Good job. Actually, he doesn't comment on the results at all. What does he comment on? He comments on their character and their faithfulness. Well done, good and faithful. What's he delighted in? He's delighted not in what they achieved for him. He's delighted in the fact that they served him well and faithfully. It's interesting when he comes back and says, you've been faithful with a little bit. Now, in my economy, if I was the guy with 5 talents, that's a lot of money. $6 million, that's not a little to me. That's an awful lot. $2.4 million. That's a lot of money. But yet the master comes and says, you've been faithful with a little amount. I'm going to put you in charge of a whole lot. So clearly the amount and the wealth wasn't the issue to the master. His delight wasn't in the fact that he got a little bit more than what he'd left them with. His delight was in them. And he says, come and share your master's happiness. But what about the third guy? From verse 24, then the man who had received the one talent came. Master, he said, I knew that you're a hard man, harvesting where you have not sown and gathering where you have not scattered seed. So I was afraid and went out and hid your talent in the ground. See, here is what belongs to you. His master replied, you wicked, lazy servant. So you knew that I harvest where I have not sown and gather where I have not scattered seed? Well then, you should have put my money on deposit with the bankers, so that when I returned I would have received it back with interest. Take the talent from him and give it to the one who has the 10 talents. For everyone who has will be given more, and he will have an abundance. Whoever does not have, even what he has will be taken from him. And throw that worthless servant outside into the darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. What was the problem here with this guy? The other two did well. They worked faithfully over a long period of time. They doubled the money. What was wrong with this guy that he didn't do that? Was it a lack of ability? Well, no. The first two guys had different levels of ability. They had different responsibilities. And they both worked hard. They were both good and faithful. Ability is not the issue. Let's look at his excuse. The master's a tyrant. And he was afraid of the master, and therefore he hid the money so that he wouldn't lose it. Now, he didn't want to maybe put it to work and find that he lost the whole lot. Maybe he was low on confidence in his own abilities. Maybe that was the problem. He was afraid of the master and really not sure about himself. Could it be true that the master was really a tyrant? Well, we'll deal with that in a minute. But I just want to stop and pause for a minute and think, what would his life have been like in that waiting period? We know that the first two servants, they were hard at work, not for their own profit, but for their masters. They were good and faithful, and they saw themselves as servants of someone else. They were serving the master. This guy, who is he serving? Not the master. That's right, he was serving himself. I was afraid. I didn't want to get in trouble, so I hid your money. And then what did he do? Well, he was free, wasn't he? He could go and look after himself, maybe get a job working for somebody else, look after his own ambitions, maybe pursue a different line of work, maybe just put his feet up. I don't know what he did, but the issue was he could then do whatever he chose. And over a long period of time, who's the winner? It looks like he is. Because he's probably maybe feathering his own nest. He might be becoming a little bit wealthier himself if he's any good at what he's been doing. He's going ahead in life. The other two are suckers. They're working for the master. They're not profiting. They're not getting ahead in life. They're working for somebody who may never return. They're looking forward to a reward they might never receive. It looks like he's the smart one, and they're the ones wasting their lives. But then the master comes back. The master returns. Was he really a tyrant? Was the third servant really paralyzed by fear and in doubt over his own abilities? Were the first two motivated by fear, and that's why they worked so hard for him? They didn't want to be punished when the master got back. Well, I want to leave the story there for a while and go back to the world of reality TV. Is there such a thing anyway as reality TV? But that's another discussion. In those shows that some of us watch, and different ones of us have particular favourites, most of them use a basic motivation. It's carrot and stick. Right, we want to succeed in those shows because we don't want to be the one who gets voted off. We don't want to suffer rejection. We don't want to suffer humiliation. We don't want to suffer whatever the punishment is for missing out. We don't want to miss out on the reward that's on offer. So there's a stick that motivates people to get going, and they work hard. I saw a little bit of The Amazing Race. I don't watch it regularly, but I was amazed at the desperation. You've got people shoving hot chili down their throat and running as fast as they can. Why are they working so hard? They're terrified of coming last. There's a stick behind them driving them on. But then there's the carrot. And I saw an ad for the Renovators show, or is it The Block? And whoever wins, they get the profit from all the sale of these houses that they're doing up. And so there's something that's enticing them. If only I can stay in it to the very end, if only I can win, I'm going to make money. and I'm going to be seen to be the best. I'm going to get a husband. I'm going to win some money. I'm going to improve my self-esteem. There's something in it for me. You know what? As servants of God, carrots and sticks don't work for us. And that's part of the message of what Jesus is trying to say. A fear of punishment does not motivate somebody to work hard for God. It didn't motivate this guy, did it? He was afraid of punishment, so what did he do? Did he work hard? No. You read the other stories Jesus told where servants are left in charge of things and they're abusing their co-workers and all sorts of things. Fear is not a strong enough motivation to keep us on track for our service for God. And neither is the thought of reward. We need something more. Do you still remember the words of Jesus to Peter? Peter, do you love me? Do you love me? It doesn't actually go into detail for those first two servants, but I wonder if they actually knew their master better than that third guy did. I wonder if they were able to go the distance in serving him, not profiting themselves, but working hard for their master, not because they were afraid of him, because they loved him. Because as I read the Bible, that's really the only motivation that really cuts it for God's people. 1 John chapter 4 and verse 16. God is love. Whoever lives in love lives in God and God in him. And in this way, love is made complete among us, so we'll have confidence on the day of judgment. Because in this world, we are like him. There's no fear in love, but perfect love drives out fear, because fear has to do with punishment. When you imagine yourself standing before Jesus and giving an account of your life, when he evaluates your life and sees what you've done as his servant in the time that he gave you, are you a little bit afraid of what that's going to be like? Am I going to have done enough? Am I going to have earned enough return on the investments, the things that God gave me? Did I use them well enough? Did I use my time? Did I use my money? Did I use the relationships? Did I use the spiritual gifts? Did I do enough to please him? You know what? That's not the motivation for our service. Perfect love, when we know the love God has for us, it drives out all those fears because we know that we have God's love. We know we have his approval. And we know that because we're becoming like him in this world. Fear has to do with punishment. The one who fears is not made perfect in love. You know, I've read Matthew 25 heaps of times and I've taught it before, and I worry sometimes that maybe I've taught it wrong. And maybe I've said, see this, guys? The master is coming back. You are going to be judged one day, so make sure you're working hard. Don't be like that third guy. You better work hard because you're going to be judged. Well, you know what? It's a misuse of the story. Yes, we need to be aware that judgment is coming. But should we be afraid of it? Should we be guilted into working because of it? No. An acknowledgement of judgment is not the same as a fear of judgment. We need to be aware of that. 2 Corinthians 5 says this, "For Christ's love compels us," in verse 14, "because we are convinced that one died for all, and therefore all died. And he died for all, that those who live should no longer live for themselves, but for him who died for them and was raised again." In other words, we are changed from the inside out by God's love. So instead of being people like the third servant who really serve ourselves, who are interested in our own preservation or our own profit, we don't work that way anymore. We operate by a different standard. We are actually changed to become servants, servants who serve through love. I believe that it's very easy for churches to produce guys like that last guy, the wicked, selfish servant who was lazy. And we can do that in a couple of ways. We can focus on what we should do for God, and we can resort to that carrot and stick. You know, God's going to punish you if you don't work hard enough. Make sure that when he gets back, he'll be pleased with you. Or, you know, the reward you get if you'll sacrifice now, it's going to be great. You know, really work hard, because in heaven, oh, you'll get a beautiful reward. Have you ever heard teaching like that? I have. But you know what? It's not how the Bible motivates us for love. What that does is produce selfish Christians. I don't want to get punished. I want a reward. Who's it all about? It's all about me. That produces shallow service, not the service over the long haul that these other two servants produced. The other thing that churches can do is we can focus on us in terms of what God can do for you. He's going to bless your socks off. He's going to give you everything you need to make your life here as wonderful as you want it to be. Again, it's all about us. Is it going to produce service? No. It's going to make us worthless, lazy, wicked servants. True Christianity teaches that it is all about God's grace and what he's done for us. He's given his life for us. He's saved us. He's transforming us so that we are like him. We become a servant because he is a servant. We love because he loves. We purify ourselves because he is pure. These are the things the Bible keeps saying over and over again. And if you're not becoming like Jesus, it doesn't mean you need to work harder at it. It means you need to get to know him more. The big problem for that third servant, he didn't know his master, whereas the first two did. Here's a great saying that I heard several years ago. A missionary is not someone who crosses the seas. A missionary is someone who sees the cross. Why should we do what we've been challenged to do over this last month? Why should we give of ourselves in all the different expressions of that? Our time, our finances, our prayers, even where we live. Why should we contemplate doing things for God and his kingdom that are going to cost us on this earth? It's because we see the cross. And we see that's who God is, and that's who he's calling us to be. Will you be like the third servant who didn't really know the master and just live to serve yourself? Or will you be like the first two, who in their own ways were faithful until their master's return? Will the love of Christ compel you? Will you live no longer for yourself, but for the one who saved you? Live as though judgment is near, but not in fear, in joyful anticipation, because the one you love is coming to call you to be with himself.